Lay my head on a surgeon's table. Take my fingerprints if you are able. Pick my brains, pick my pockets. Steal my eyeballs, then come back for the sockets. Run every kind of test from A to Z. You still know nothing about me. All right. Good evening, everybody. How you doing? It's Steph. Oh, Wednesday Night Live. It's been a while. Feels like it's been a while. And I hope you're having a great week. Thank you, of course, for all of your support. Your wonderful, delightful, delicious, lovely support of philosophy. And I am happy to hear your questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems. Thank you, StephBot. Your hardworking conversations are making big improvements in my life. Wonderful, wonderful. Now, technically, of course, it is you who are making the big improvements in your life, but of course, if I have helped a little bit, you know, if my recipes have helped you be a better cook, fantastic. I appreciate that. I haven't listened in a while. It's so good to hear you. Well, it's great to hear you too. All right, so let me just get the questions cooking around, floating around, being around in their own tippy-tappy-toppy way. And, of course, a big thanks to everyone who's done call-in shows. Man, you guys are the best. Does it ever help me explicate philosophy when it comes to call-in shows? It really, really helps. So, and I just spent the day working on John Locke, picking the lock, so to speak. And I've managed to wrestle down and overcome my pathological hatred for the History of Philosophers series that I talked about in show 17 of that series. Man alive, it was brutal. I've never had quite as visceral a reaction to my own projects as that. Oh, man, it was rough. It was rough. But, you know, a little bit of introspection, and we've managed to get there. And we have survived. We have survived. All right. Let's see here. Go back to the chat. Who's your favorite public intellectual? That's a good question. It's a good question. Who's my favorite? You know, I mean, I've gone through my phases. I've gone through my phases of people that I've liked. The problem is, and I mean, I may be putting myself on a pedestal here, so maybe this is fair, maybe it's not. So there are people who I like who are good in a specific area, and then for reasons that completely pass understanding, they jump out of that arena into something that they have no training, no knowledge, no competence, no integrity in, and they start waffle-burgering about stuff that they don't know the content, right? It'd be like, hey, I'm good at philosophy, so I think I'm just going to start mainlining physics in a powdered form up my nose and then spewing out a bunch of equations, and the physicists are all looking at me like, okay, if we were to judge your philosophy, by the way, we judge your physics, you ain't a philosopher or a physicist. So there are a lot of people, I'm sure you know, in general, who I'm talking about. Like, let's say they're really good at atheism, right? And they have good arguments regarding the existence of God, good arguments about the scientific method, good arguments regarding material skepticism and so on. Okay, yeah, feed me up, fill me up, okay? And then what happens is they take those exact same principles of universalism, they take those exact same principles, and what do? They completely abandon them when they move over to politics. And that's tragic. It's kind of heartbreaking. It's depressing as hell. Ah, you see, well, there should be no centralized authority for science. Hashtag not Fauci. Right, so there should be no centralized authority for science. Everybody should be able to pursue the scientific method in and of themselves, and it should be a free-wheeling, free-market debate of ideas where the best and most consistent ideas that are the most reproducible according to the scientific method, those ideas should win, and universalism is key, and everyone can be a scientist. You know, who? I mean, anyone. Everyone can be a scientist. No central authority. And then they move from, say, the scientific method and material skepticism and atheism over to the state. And suddenly they're worshipping at the altar of centralized authority and the priesthood and Satanism of state worship. I mean, it's just wild. Absolutely wild. And for me, you know, I've always... I was literally devastated when I read Judgment Day by Barbara Brandon about what happened with Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon, the affair and all of this giant mess that occurred in that community. Just horrendously anti-rational. And after reading Ayn Rand's, you know, Joy of Life and Sense of Life and truly inspiring portraits of heroic and joyous battlers of the status quo, and then seeing her sort of hard, suspicious, goblin-style eyes when she was being interviewed and this hostility. And look, I know, I get that, you know, the people were hostile towards her, but even in relatively friendly environs, she was pretty, you know, kind of hunched over. And again, you know, I mean, there are times when I've been interviewed where it hasn't been hugely comfortable, but I think I've always tried to keep that positive sense of life and enthusiasm for things, even in the face of significant hardship. And yeah, just the disaster of that community and really what was sacrificed at the altar of sexual vanity and so on was just really terrible. A lot of the credibility of objectivism went up in smoke, and a lot of the forward momentum of the community went up in smoke, because I assume Ayn Rand wanted to get laid by a younger guy. And obviously he was keen on it too, although they were both married. And yeah, it was just a mess. And so, you know, when you have your heroes, yeah, I mean, a lot of times they will disappoint you. I mean, I'm sure I will disappoint you one day. I really do try my very best not to, and to have integrity and sort of stand tall in the face of principles and not back down from positions that I have not had disproven to me, or where the reason and evidence has not gone against my position and so on. But yeah, favorite intellectuals, they're divided into these vertical spheres. You know, I may go to person A for something about science. I may go to person B for something about morality, but I wouldn't necessarily listen to them about objective reason. And oh my God, it was, it's really terrible to find somebody who's taken a principle that they're famous for in one area and actually apply it objectively to another area, right? Like a lot of the atheists are very keen on democracy, but then, you know, when the wrong person gets elected, they're just ferocious and attack. And it's just, yeah, it's just, it's pretty wretched to watch people, you know, who may be very good sculptors, and then they go into dance and they think they're great dancers when they just look like they're having some sort of seizure while being hit by lightning and don't even seem to notice the discrepancy. And when somebody wanders into a field that they're very bad at and thinks that they have all of this amazing competence, when anybody with any training and in focus on consistency and integrity can just see that they're just wildly out of their depth and they don't even seem to notice it. You know, you don't notice me auditioning to be like an opera singer, right? Because I'm an okay amateur singer, but, you know, I mean, I don't have any particularly great voice. So I think I'm fairly aware of my limitations and the things that I'm good at and the things that I'm not particularly good at. And I try to avoid the things I'm not particularly good at and pursue the things I am good at and work to get better at the things that I'm good at. Because when somebody goes into a field that they're bad at and don't even seem to notice, then it means that not only do they not know how bad they are at that field, it also means that there isn't anyone around them who's going to tell them the truth that they're bad at that field. And it is very common, of course, when people go from atheistic materialism and the individualism of the sovereign consciousness that can pursue science and then go into this collectivist, semi-socialist, top-down authoritative. I mean, you see this in particular with somebody like Albert Einstein, obviously a brilliant physicist and mathematician and so on, who praised socialism and praised Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, right? One of the great mass murderers of the 20th century, who set up the entire Gulag system and slaughtered the kulaks and the Christians and the Ukrainians by the millions, or set the process up by which that occurred. And for Albert Einstein to, you know, take his obvious brilliance in the realm of physics and mathematics and science and then try and move it into the political realm, where it's just like, oh man, just it's sort of like you're dating some really, really, really pretty girl and she just doesn't have anything to say, and you just want to go out to have an evening where you look at her and she keeps talking, and it's like, no, stick to your lane. And the sticking to your lane thing is something that's relentlessly disappointing. when it comes. I mean, it's sort of like it was great before the rise of social media when you didn't know all of the retarded positions that celebrities had on just about everything and anything, right? Arnold Schwarzenegger, inspiring guy for physical health and an entertaining and charismatic actor and an indifferent waste a decade of your life governor of California, who then basically says, fuck your freedoms to people who aren't vaccinated. And it's like, ah, oh, great. It's nice to have an Austrian tell everyone fuck their feelings because fuck their freedoms because that's never happened before in history, has it? So it's nice when you could just enjoy people's art without worrying about their politics, or you could enjoy people's science without worrying about their politics in general. It's the politics that are the big issue. Or you could say, ah, this person is very rational. And then, you know, they come out as socialists or communists or fascists. And it's like, oh, okay, well, then their rationality is like, it's like they're insane, but they occasionally get possessed by the demon of rationality, if that makes any sense. So I wouldn't say that I have any particular favorite intellectuals in the here and now. And again, I try and pick and choose with people who I can focus on a particular thing that they do and try and ignore just about everything else. Oh, yeah. And Trump was the big measure of this, right? I mean, Trump derangement syndrome was the big measure of this. People just went completely insane on Trump, and it was just, Steph, your work truly gets better. Your quality never declines. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's one of the reasons why I lift weights is that the science seems to be pretty clear that if you lift weights, your capacity for dementia is significantly diminished. All right. Let's see here. What other questions do we have going on here? Hey, Steph. I'm listening to The Origins of War and Child Abuse right now. And have to say, it is truly disturbing. Can you please help me understand how people were able to be so cruel and evil towards children? This seems to go completely against evolution and our natural mammalian instincts. Thanks. Yes, you do. You do have a great question. That's a big, long-ass question. So I want to make sure that I don't completely eclipse everyone else's questions. So let me just make a tiny note of that, and I will get to that before the end of the show. I may do the end of this subscriber only, so maybe I'll answer it there, but I'll answer it for sure. All right. Oh, yeah, Bill Gates, too. Like, you know, hey, good at software, good at business, but dear God, as far as public health goes, he's basically Moloch on steroids. All right. In a free society, what would happen with all the government's weapons? For example, its nuclear weapons, jets, tanks, guns, etc. Well, I assume that they would be decommissioned. So, let's see here. Is it possible for men and women to be close friends if there is a possibility of romance? Or will the friend zone end the friendship? Yeah, so you hear a lot of this stuff. And I will tell you my frank and open experience and thoughts and observations and so on, right? Okay. Gotta remember. What is the purpose of life and what is the purpose of male and female? The purpose of life and the purpose of male and female is the begetting and raising of children. That is what underlies everything. That's why we're all here, because for a couple of million generations, the life has managed to reproduce and raise its young to the point where we exist. So the purpose of life is not the making of money. And I'm talking about the physical purpose, the sort of philosophical purpose is virtue. Well, the purpose is happiness and the methodology is reason and virtue. But so physically, like why we're all here to even practice philosophy is because of sexual attraction, fertility, conception, birth, and the raising of children. And the reason why we're not apes is because people have raised their children with the accumulated values and wisdom of centuries. Well, millennia, 100, 150,000 years, maybe 200,000 years, depending on when you think that we first got bald and dropped out of the trees. But yeah, the purpose of life is the making of more life. And the purpose, the only reason we have a civilization of any kind is because we raise children with wisdom and knowledge. You know, my daughter is navigating her teen relationships, which are wonderful and very positive and all of that. But there's a lot of knowledge transfer, a lot of feedback transfer on how to reason, how to deal with conflict, how to encourage people, how to inspire people, how to push back against people who are not always super positive. You know, there's a lot of the dance, a lot of the negotiation that goes on in life, and teaching her virtues and values is very, very important. And because most of us were raised, I don't even know what to say. We weren't even raised like wolves, because wolves actually raise their children. But, you know, the sort of post-boomer generations, we just raised, like everyone just threw us in front of the television and they went out and had key parties while we had to try and figure out what the hell was going on with all the counter-cultural crap shotgunning our faces on a regular basis, and leftist propaganda swamping us in schools, and hypersexualized media attacking us over VCR tapes and the internet. And yeah, just wild. You know, what we've had to survive to get any shred of rational adulthood has been one of the greatest counteroffensive to the development of reason in the history of the world, has occurred since the 1960s onwards. And, you know, here we are standing and reasoning with each other because we are fucking tough guys. And we managed to not only make it through, but become stronger through the adversity, as we saw so many of our companions, friends, and childhood accomplices mowed down by the endless sandblasting, countervailing currents of brain disassembling statist propaganda and leftist propaganda and rightist propaganda and so on. So it is, it's been a brutal history, and we have really struggling to keep the fires of our civilization alight in the coming winter of the discontent of reason. So we did manage to sort of make it that far, which has not been easy at all. And again, you know, if you've made it this far to this part of the conversation, like, congratulations on you. I mean, the amount of hysterical hatred that's out there for reason, for science, for history, for morality, man, we've gone pretty savage. So the purpose, of course, of life is reproduction. So can you be friends with, if you're single, can you be friends with another single woman of reproductive age? The answer is, of course not. Of course not. So since the purpose of life is reproduction, you have to sort of maintain your availability out there, right? There's a reason why, you know, the dot on the forehead for women in India if they're married, the ring on the finger, lots of cultures have, I'm taken, I'm in a monogamous relationship, and the absence of that marker means that you're in the market and available for other people. So if you have a strong emotional bond with a woman you're attracted to, or a young woman, we're just going to say it's a young man, young woman attracted to each other, or with, you know, potential for feelings for each other, then you are half out of the game because your pair bonding is happening with a woman. You say, ah, yes, well, it's not sex. Well, remember, pair bonding used to happen long before sex, right? Because you'd date, you'd get engaged, and then when you got married, after that, you would have sex. So it could be 6-12 months where you were friends, or maybe kissing a little, but, you know, keep the door open and one foot on the floor at all times, as they used to say in the dorm rooms in the past. So if you are in proximity with a woman you really like, right? And friendship, of course, if it's not based on lust, it's going to be based on shared values, right? You both have the same ethics, you both have the same life view, you both have the same methodology for resolving conflicts. And we're going to say it's positive. Of course, you can have negative friendships that way as well. And if you like each other enough to be friends and you're both single, then why wouldn't you get married? I mean, it's always been kind of curious to me. You know, this is, I'm sure it drives women as well nuts, but it drives me nuts, or drove me nuts when I was a young single man, that you'd like some girl and you'd become friends with her and you'd really enjoy each other's company. And, you know, at some point or another, you might make a play to move her or upgrade her to girlfriend status. And she'd be like, no, I just think of you as a friend, which generally means that she wants to date tattooed alcoholic losers who require them to come to the hospital after they crash their motorcycle into a cop car to bail them out and give them blood. So yeah, the friend zone stuff is weird because it's like, well, wait a minute, we really enjoy each other's company. We enjoy conversation. We share the same values. We like the same movies. We have the same sense of life. We like the same authors. And why on earth wouldn't we then become boyfriend and girlfriend? Like, it doesn't really make any sense. So if you're pair bonding with another young, attractive woman, your heart is flowing in that direction, it means it's less available to another woman. So you kind of, you're going off the river path and you're going into this dead end. Like I remember some years ago, I did canoeing among the mangrove trees in Florida, like in the south of Florida, Florida Keys. And I was with my wife and we would go paddling into these mangrove little rivers and rivulets. And, you know, at one point it was just like we'd gone so far off the main river. We were actually looking for a manatee, which we'd heard was in the neighborhood. And we just kept going forward. And then we just ended up in a complete dead end, and backing out was really, really tough. And I remember like being really tricky and, you know, stuff poking you in the back, like you're on honeymoon. And so I just remembered. And so if you're getting involved with a woman of your age, you share the values, you like each other, great conversations, great friends, why wouldn't you get together? Why wouldn't you just get together if you like each other so much, right? Or and if you're not getting together, what the hell's going on? You say, oh, well, we're just not attracted to each other. Oh, okay, I understand that. I mean, I'm not immune to the concept of physical attraction, however old I may seem to y'all young folks, but I get that. I get that. Okay. So it's either the face or the body, right? I mean, if you're not attracted to a woman, it's either the face or the body. Now, if it's the face, you can't do much about your face, right? I mean, other than, you know, stay relatively healthy and fit. You can't do much about your face. But I guess you can get plastic surgery or whatever, but that's gross and kind of fraudulent, right? Because you're then saying that you possess genes for even features that you don't possess for genes for even features. It's a falsehood, right? It'd be like, I don't know, if I had a hair transplant or some sort of wig, some sort of Howard Stern style wig, it'd be like, oh, look, I possess the genes for a lifelong male hair. It's like, really don't. So if you're judging a woman by her face, let's say she's in good shape or whatever, and you're judging her by her face, that's kind of shallow, and it's throwing away a good compatible soul for the sake of something she has no control over, right? It would be like her ditching you because you were losing your hair. It's like, that's a terrible, shallow, and horrible reason. Or if you said, well, you know, I'm not dating you because your boobs aren't big enough or your boobs are too big or whatever, right? It's like, well, she didn't really have much control over that. So that's a pretty terrible reason or height, you know, to some degree, right? So if it's the body, right, like let's say you really like her and you really find her engaging and entertaining, you share values, good conversation, same art tastes and all that, all good stuff that would be for compatibility, but she's overweight. Well, then, of course, you have to ask, why is she overweight? Why is she overweight? Now, we know that BMI is inversely proportional to, say, IQ. We know that childhood trauma can lead people to overeat, particularly women. If they've had sexual trauma as children, then they will often drape flesh over their own bones in order to escape and avoid the dating market because it provokes sexual anxiety for reasons I can completely sympathize with and completely and totally understand. And my heart goes out to people who are dealing with that kind of stuff. I mean, it's really rough and, you know, big virtual hug to everyone there. But that does mean, of course, that it does mean that there may be unprocessed, there probably is some sort of unprocessed trauma, or there's some sort of lack of self-restraint, or maybe even a lack of self-respect if it's not particularly trauma-based, and therefore you may not share the values. So I think if you genuinely share values and you're both genuinely mentally healthy, as far as that can be achieved in the madhouse of the modern world, then you, I mean, I'm not saying you'd be super pathologically rock-hard abs fit and, you know, those kinds of buns that a woman, you can, you know, have her stand vertical and you can use her as a stepladder to change your garage door opener. But if you're reasonably mentally healthy, you're going to be of a reasonable weight. Again, sometimes the people who are, you know, narcissistic, I'm down to 2% body fat and I can't even walk past butter. That can be kind of rough. There's a kind of narcissism and impossibility to continually achieve aspect of that. But yeah, I think if you're mentally healthy, you'll be of a reasonable weight. Again, maybe it's super shredded, maybe it's a little overweight, but you'll be of a reasonably functional weight. So it's probably not the body. So if you are single, you share the same values, and the person is of an attractiveness level that indicates good character and good morals. Again, not the face. Don't have any choice about the face. It's just your bone structure. It's your skull structure. But if she and you are, you know, reasonably in shape and reasonably mobile and reasonably healthy as far as all of that goes, why wouldn't you get together? And then, of course, the other problem is that some other woman who comes into the orbit and you've got this super great close female friend, well, she's some new girl's not going to like that very much. So why would you be giving up your chances or reducing your chances to get with a new woman because you're friends with the other woman? And of course, you know, well, no, I won't get into that. That's a topic for another time. All right. So no, I don't think that you can be close friends. Because again, the purpose of life is reproduction. And if you share values and you're reasonably attractive, why wouldn't you just get together? It doesn't make any sense, right? All right. Let's see here. I think that it really matters on how anarchy is achieved. If it's a collapse of power, I imagine people will simply take public resources and some elements of the military will retain control over those assets. No, but so prior political revolutions were always based on collapse and coercion. Right, I'm just, of course, with John Locke, you have to get into the Glorious Revolution. You have to get into the end of the monarchy for a brief period in the UK. You have to get into France's pursuit of 400,000, well, conversion of hundreds of thousands, the murder of hundreds of thousands of Protestants, and you have to get John Locke fleeing to Holland, where he lived 4 or 5 years, because Holland, while it had its Calvinists, was still the most religiously tolerant country in Europe. So you have to get into all of that kind of stuff, and all of that is about violence and revolution, and you just, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. All prior revolutions have been based upon collapse and coercion, collapse of credibility, a collapse of liberty, followed by coercive overthrow and a revolution. If you want something radically different in the future, you can't do what you've done in the past, right? Anybody who does the same thing that's happened in the past countless times and expects a different result, kind of crazy, right? What's the old definition of insanity? Is doing the same thing over and over, but expecting a different result. I mean, so this collapse and coercion model of changing political masters is not going to work. I would in no way, shape, or form take the risks that I have taken, put myself out there, and taken the not inconsiderable punishments that I've taken. I would not do that in order to rewind the horror movie, play it again, and hope it has a different ending. Just not interested in that. That's not what I would spend. I would have taken my talents and put them into politics or sophistry or leadership in some public fashion, which I am, you know, eminently qualified for and have a great skill set in. Like, I'm a good manager, I'm a good leader, I'm a good public speaker, I'm a great debater, lots of things that I could have done in the public sphere. And yet what I want, of course, is not a reproduction of the general catastrophes, physics, and disasters of history. I would have no interest in that. I would not even bother with philosophy if it was simply a matter of, well, you know, let's end something corrupt and then put something else in that's inevitably going to become corrupt. And I was interviewed by Reason Magazine many years ago at a conference, talked about this. So, yeah, I have no interest, right? No interest whatsoever in rewinding a movie, playing it forward, and thinking that it's going to magically have some kind of different ending. That's, no, absolutely not. It'd be like, basically, would you get involved with a woman if you knew it was going to be a horrendous breakup? Right? Would you marry a woman and have children with her if you knew it was going to be a god-awful, drag-your-ass-backwards-through-the-bramble-bush of family courts kind of divorce? No, of course you wouldn't, right? Would you date a woman if you knew for sure that during the breakup she was going to accuse you of crime, spread lies, and key your car? Boil your bunny, so to speak, right? Of course you wouldn't, right? So I have no interest in trying to achieve something that will inevitably achieve disaster in the future, as it has countless times throughout human history. You do not achieve peace through collapse and coercion. And for more on the full explication of all of this, you can check out my Atlas Shrugged version of the science fiction novel that I wrote called The Future, right here on this platform. You can support for free, actually, UPB2022, all caps, UPB2022 is the promo code. You can use that. But I have no interest in that. So the way that we get to a free society is not through violence, but through peace. Through pacifism. And pacifism with regards to one class of citizens that is the most aggressed against, the most constrained, the most enslaved, the most bullied, the most indoctrinated, and that class of citizens, of course, is children. As children, everybody who's out there in the public square endlessly caterwauling about their victimhood without mentioning children, no interest, no credibility. It's just a diversion from the truly oppressed in society, which are the children. Which are the children. So, if we declare peace against our children, we stop mutilating them, we stop dumping them in daycare, so therefore breaking the bond and not breastfeeding with them as much. We give them eye contact and skin-on-skin touch and breastfeeding and peace and reason and happiness, and we don't hit them and we don't neglect them and we don't indoctrinate them and we don't abandon them. If we declare peace against our children, there will be no war in the future. That's the equation. That's the only thing that can change. And that's the one thing that's never been tried before. Right? I mean, in my sort of explication of John Locke and the, for his time in the late 1600s, early 1700s, for his time, the explication of materialistic empirical philosophy, well, they didn't understand the trauma of child abuse and its effect on adulthood. And how could they, really? They were all traumatized themselves. And they didn't understand or have access to the theory of evolution, which helps us understand why the senses are the way they are, and that the purpose of the senses is not the explication of epistemological truth. The purpose of the senses is the aiding of survival. Right? That's what the senses are designed for. Because if you think that the senses are designed by God or a watchmaker, then you're going to try and interpret their capacities and limits and potentials with regards to a designer. But if you understand that the senses evolved in Darwinian natural selection, then you can understand that we are attempting to repurpose our senses by pointing them at philosophical truth, because the senses were designed to give us material, a survival and advantage over other predators, right? The pursuit of prey and the avoidance of predators is why the senses are developed, and what sharpens them is not doing a good job at those things. So again, we'll sort of get into all of this when I do John Locke, and it's actually pretty wild. So I have an ancestor, William Molyneux. I did a show on this many years ago, but John Locke was talking about a syllogistical explanation of metaphysics, a syllogistical explanation of epistemology. He worked on a syllogistical explanation of the evidence of the senses and the tabula rasa theory, that we're born a blank slate and all knowledge in the mind comes through the evidence of the senses. He did a syllogistical explication of political power and the existence of God and so on. And my ancestor, William Molyneux, who was great friends with John Locke, said to old Johnny Boy, "You know, it's really great that you're doing all of these syllogistical explanations." He said, "You know, one thing I noticed that you wrote, John, you wrote that morals could be explained and proven according to syllogistical reasoning as well. Morals could be demonstrated, explained, and proven by syllogistical arguments. You should really do that. You really, really, John Locke, you are the guy. Reason, empiricism, syllogism, you are the guy. You must make it as your primary project, the explication of rational, secular morality." So my ancestor couldn't do it. He couldn't convince John Locke to do it. So it fell to me. And that's a beautiful thing. So, yeah, the way that we get a free society is we stop waging war on our children, and then we won't have society wage war on us as adults, right? It's all blowback. Don't forget, you can tip me, which I would very much appreciate, on this live stream. All right. Hi, Steph. I remember a guy who talked to you who was considering taking an interest-free loan from his father-in-law to buy a house. You told him he'd lose his wife's respect or something along those lines. So at that time, I wondered if buying my son a house in the future would be a good idea. I would very much appreciate your thoughts on that. Yeah, I mean, look, of course. I mean, I'm a parent. What do we want to do? We want to make our children's life easier than ours. Naturally. It's inevitable. Because we look back at the suffering that we experience and we want our children to avoid that. It is a big question. And again, I go into this with the character of Roman, one of the great depictions, in my humble opinion, of the noble savage in the history of literature. The character of Roman basically says there's no kindness in removing suffering from your children. You're just setting them up for failure. If you buy your son a house, what are you saying to him? If you buy your son a house, what are you saying to him? You're saying, son, I don't believe that you can never buy a house on your own. Can't do it. Can't do it. Sorry. Now, again, I understand that interest rates are up and housing costs are up and wages have been stagnant since the 1970s, since the welfare-warfare state really took off. I get all of that. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not being old economy Steve and just saying, hey, you can just do what I did. I get all of that. I understand that. But your son can figure it out. The purpose of real estate is to relocate you to safety. That's the purpose of real estate. Right, so where's real estate very expensive? In the cities. What are the most dangerous locations in the moment and in the future? The cities. Right, so real estate is economics begging you to relocate to safer locales. So get out into the country and try and get your own food supply and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, right? So your son will figure it out. Your son will figure it out. And you can be there as a resource to help him figure it out, but whatever you do for people, you're implicitly saying they can't do for themselves. And well, perfectly understandable, babies can't feed themselves, so you feed the baby, right? But doing things for your children when they're adults is a vote of non-confidence in their abilities to do things for themselves. And he will not be able to attract a strong equality woman, right? So a woman, deep down, is instinctually testing a man's assertive, aggressive, dominant capacity to win resources at the expense of other men. Now, I get in the modern economy, it's much more win-win than it used to be in the past economy. I get all of that. But we evolved, and a woman has to know, in order to feel secure, a woman has to know that you're going to be out there and you'll elbow guys aside to get the resources. And if you have to step on their backs, you'll be willing to do that too, metaphorically, or maybe even literally, like in the distant past, right? So, a woman can only relax when she knows that if there's food out there, her husband's going to get it. And if that means at the expense of some other kid, some other husband, some other wife, too bad. So sad. Like, a woman, think of the course of winter in Siberia or Northern Europe and so on, right? Well, you're bound to the land, right? So you can't leave the land. You're a serf, perhaps, right? You're bound to the land. How is the woman going to feel if she spends all spring, summer, and fall gathering together resources for the winter, right? Her husband brings it home and she pickles it, she jams it, she salts it, she does whatever, right? Whatever the medieval equivalent is of dehydrated, freeze-dried suction bags or something like that. So how comfortable is she going to be when she has just enough food for the kids over the winter? And of course, she could get pregnant over the course of the winter, probably would. Spend a lot of time in bed when it's cold out. So she's going to need all those extra calories for pregnancy, growing a baby and all. Or maybe she's pregnant going into it. She's going to need all those extra calories for breastfeeding, like in that old Desperate Housewives show where the woman kept breastfeeding her kid because she didn't want to gain any weight. How comfortable is your wife going to be if she thinks that every Tom, Dick, loser, and Harry who comes knocking on your door come February, you're just going to hand out food like candy at the expense of your own family, your own children? No, no, no. She needs to know that you're going to slam and bar that door, and you're going to damn well make sure that people don't get the food that she and you have prepared for the winter, for the family, for the kids. She needs to know that you're affectionate to her and cold, cold-hearted to anyone who interferes with her survival and the survival of the children. She wants you to be a team player because you probably need, well, you need to raise a barn, to plow a field, to hunt a deer. It's better when you do it in a group, right? She needs you to be a team player. But she also needs you to be ruthless when it comes to protecting your own family's interests. And I get that that's a bit of a contradiction. I understand all of that. But, you know, men want women to be both sexy and maternal. It's not like women don't have to live with their own contradictions. I get all of that, right? So, if the woman doubts, and this is why some women will do what's called the shit test, right? Which is kind of come at you hard, and she wants you to stand your ground, to neither, you know, get hysterically angry and fight back, and but also not give way and cow down and all of that. She needs to test your levels of assertiveness, because she can't relax if you're not assertive. Because if you're not assertive, she's probably not going to make it. Her kid's probably not going to make it. You need to be tough and assertive out there in the marketplace. And if it's a choice between your kids eating or some other dude's kids eating, you're going to choose your kids and not lose a moment's sleep in it, right? So all of that stuff, I think, is pretty important. So with all of that, if you take over the resource provision for your son's wife will lose respect for your son. We weren't raised by wolves, we were thrown to them. Yeah, that's true. I'm starting to think that the best approach to life is to ask a boomer for advice about something, then just do the opposite of what they say. Yes. Yes. Well, if you want to teach someone to hate someone else, you must first teach that person to exploit the other person. Right, so if you want Bob to hate Harry, the best way to do it is to get Bob to exploit Harry. Because when you exploit Harry, when Bob exploits Harry, he will end up with dependence and resentment. And he will resent, he will have to downgrade Harry in Bob's mind, because Bob is exploiting Harry. And the boomers exploited the next generations by wanting the warfare welfare state, by letting the state grow and taxes grow and national debts grow without being willing to give up any of their benefits. So the boomers exploited the next generation, and therefore they resent the next generation and won't take any criticism at all. So, yeah, it's very sad. All right. Steph, I'm 31. I'm 30 wonderful. I'm curious what age range you think is relatively acceptable for a couple. Obviously, man, as a man, I want a woman as young as I can get. But is there a certain distance of years where it's a bit more than an obstacle? Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you're 31 and you marry an 18-year-old woman, I mean, that's a good 13 years of experience differences between you, and it's going to be a little bit tough to have had the same life experience in someone, right? Yeah, I read this article about how, what's the third of men under 30 haven't had any romantic or sexual contact over the last year? That's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. Let's see here. Steph, what do you think of a single, financially stable, work-from-home man adopting a child 4 to 6 years old and trying to make an impact on the life with peaceful parenting and facilitating their natural curiosity? Do you think it would have enough of an effect to make a huge difference? Do you think the trauma has already set them on a course? I don't know, because there's a lot that you can do with trauma. Obviously, I mean, I hope that I'm to some degree a marker of that. There's a lot you can do with trauma to turn it to your advantage, right? Why do I strive and I think relatively achieve? Why do I strive and relatively achieve such a focus on rationality, on empiricism? Because I was raised in the Moloch mysticism of the 1970s, right? I mean, where it was all like crystals and UFOs and, oh, you put your razor blade under a pyramid and it sharpens overnight, and there's ESP, and I actually got in the newspaper, believe it or not, I got in the newspaper for spoon bending in the Toronto Sun back in the day with my friend. And yeah, it was a mystical, horrible, hypersexualized decade. And that pushed me really towards really being rational and empirical and philosophical, because, man, I've seen how this mysticism plays out. And yeah, it's fun and kooky and a little woo-woo when you're young, but you really do court mental illness with mysticism. Like, you really, really, really do court mental illness with mysticism. And I think a lot of the craziness that we see in society at the moment, this lack of capacity to have definitions or standards or virtues or rational beliefs of any kind, is because a lot of these people were raised by mystics, a lot of them raised by single moms who tend more towards mysticism, in my experience. And yeah, it's just the inevitable outcome, right? I mean, fathers got banished from the household, and within a generation and a half, we don't even know what a man is anymore, right? So it's pretty rough. So you can do a lot with trauma to improve, but I think you need a certain amount of intelligence to get the most traction in that situation. Look, there's a lot of wisdom that you can give people who aren't quite as smart, and I would rather be less intelligent with more wisdom than have more intelligence and less wisdom. So it really depends, of course, what's happened to the kid ahead of time. But what I would do is just look into the research of what is the family structure that children benefit the most from, and then try and reproduce that family structure for whoever you adopt. But yeah, with adoption, you're definitely rolling the dice a little because you don't have any control over the origin story. Stefan, how can I overcome my shallowness? It's hard for me to date a woman who I do not find attractive. This is causing me to chase after all the wrong women. Any insights would be appreciated. Right. Right. The stoner in my high school had a t-shirt, and it said, good girls do. Sorry, let me start that again. It said, bad girls do. Good girls don't. I might. Edgy. There's this myth, of course, that unstable women will give you a lifetime of wild sex. Or, you know, they're hot, they're sexy, and all of that. So a woman who presents herself in an overly sexualized manner is merely broadcasting her self-contempt. I mean, on the old Frasier show, and I guess all the way back to Cheers, there was this kind of joke about how long it would take Frasier Crane, Dr. Frasier Crane, how long it would take Frasier Crane to announce that he'd been schooled at Harvard. Like, he just couldn't possibly have a conversation without talking about his being a psychiatrist and being educated at Harvard and so on, right? And if you've ever had a friend who, let's say, has a lot of money, and your friend, you know, just shows up in really glitzy outfits with a very expensive watch and a really expensive car, and right, he just can't show up as himself. He's got to show up with the me plus. You know, or if you know a guy with a nice physique who's like, whoa, it's mildly warm in here. Let me just take off my shirt. you know, it's okay. We got it. You got a nice physique. So, you know, Matthew McConaughey, it's not that cold. It's not that warm everywhere in the world. So if you've got something that's particularly appealing and you kind of milk it and you put it front and center, you're just shining a bright light in people's eyes, and you know you can't see anything on the other side of that bright light. And you know, a woman who's got, a great physique, she's got those nipple headlamps going, you can't see the personality outside the bright glare of the Gestapo-style nipple headlamps. The one headlight. So a woman who's presenting herself in an overtly sexual manner is saying, I have to do this because if you judge me by my personality, you won't like me. Why? Because I have judged myself by my own personality and I don't like me. When you meet people, you don't know them. You just met them. But you do know that they know themselves. And a woman who puts herself forward in an over-sexualized manner, what is she telling you? She's telling you, I don't like myself. I don't like myself. So I have, the only way that I can attract men is with this sort of big, bright, bulbous anglerfish, snap, snap, jaw, jaw, swallow, swallow, poop, poop approach of sexiness. Now, if you choose a woman based on her looks, and by that I don't mean a woman who's attractive, I mean a woman who puts herself forward. Look, we all know. Yeah, you all know what I'm talking about. Say, oh, give me the definition of over-sexualized. Yeah, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Men, you know what I'm talking about. It's a saucy eye. It's the way they walk. It's the clothes they wear. It's poutiness. It's, you know, midriff bearing, tits up on the shelf. You know, you all know. You know what I'm talking about. So a woman who presents herself in an overtly sexual manner, well, I can't judge her for her personality because I just met her, but I can judge that she doesn't believe that her personality is attractive enough to get and keep a man. So she has to put her tits on a shelf because the heart is black underneath. It's like this crater, like one of these Florida sinkholes that takes up a whole house. In fact, it could literally take your house through the court system. So yeah, this sinkhole of black-heartedness under the tits on a shelf scenario is pretty rough. And so, yeah, if you're attracted to these women, it's because you are attracted to women who have not worked on themselves, but have worked on their makeup. You know, I mean, have you seen these tutorials? You know, you've seen these tutorials on the web. Men love pterodactyls. Ah. But have you seen these tutorials where women will spend an hour on their makeup? Hello? I don't wear makeup for the show, as you can probably imagine. But yeah, women spend an hour on their makeup. They won't spend an hour reading self-help books. They won't spend an hour in therapy. They won't spend an hour journaling or trying to figure out their motives or calling their estranged dad to work things out, but they'll spend an hour on their makeup. I mean, I remember I worked with a woman when I was working up north, and I had to head into town. We were in the middle of nowhere. I was heading into town. And she's like, oh, I want to come. I was like, well, come. She's like, no, 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 I got to put my face on. It's been an hour. And we were going to the grocery store in the town. She's been an hour putting her face on. She was young, attractive, right? She was like, I don't know, 22 or whatever. I was like 20. And yeah, she had to put her face on. Was it Anna Faris in some movie? I didn't watch much of it, but at the very beginning, she's so desperate to land the guy that she gets up, like she's sleeping over. She gets up early in the morning, puts the makeup on, does her hair, and then goes back to bed. Like, this is just how she wakes up, because he can't see her without makeup. Like the old joke of, you know, first date, take the woman swimming so you can see what she actually looks like. Or there's a little meme I saw about, I think it was a Japanese guy in a gym, and he was doing some climbing stuff. And, you know, you need the chalk dust. So he went up to a Japanese woman who had that sort of white hentai face or whatever, right? This kabuki theater face. And he just like rubbed her face, and then he had all the dust he needed to go climbing. And she, of course, looked like, you know, and you can see these kinds of wild transformations where, you know, apparently you can make a turnip look like J-Lo with enough makeup. Like, it's wild. Okay, so you're spending all that time focusing on your appearance. Why? Because you don't want anyone to look at your soul. They don't want anyone to look at your virtues, your character, your honesty, your integrity, your loyalty, blah, 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 right? So if you want to know why you're attracted to shallow women, my suggestion, the first place to look is, what value did your mother bring to a man? What value did your mother bring to a man? Kind of an important question. My mom, the value she brought, she was slender and very pretty. Sorry, that's it. That's all I got. She was slender and very pretty, which in the Austrian German community is not the super commonest thing in the known universe. So, look at what value did your mom bring to the table? Was she a great friend, a loyal a partner? Did she encourage? Did she help her mate? Did she just provide value other than pretty and sexy? Because look, if you date the women who put their sex in as front and center, you'll get sex quickly, but you won't get it for very long because that self-hatred is going to come out. And you kind of have to lie to that woman, right? Because you have to say, oh, I just think you're wonderful, I care about you, I love you, blah, blah, blah. But you don't, you're just physically attracted to them. That's all. You might as well say you love candy. So you got to lie to her, pretend that she's wonderful when she in fact is only available, and you actually love her for her whole, for where she's not, and it's not love. So you have to lie to her. So she has contempt for you, she has contempt for herself, for never risking being liked for who she is, but instead putting sexuality front and center, which diminishes a man's capacity to reason enormously. And why would somebody want to diminish your capacity to think. Well, they ply you with fear through propaganda, they ply you with love bombs in a cult, and they ply with the V-bomb or sexuality in the dating market. So why would she want to have you not think and not look at her personality? Because she does not like her personality and knows for sure, or believes certainly, that if you evaluate her for her personality, you'll run. So it's like cocaine. Like, it's an immediate high, but a long-term pain. Like short-term gain, long-term pain. And that's what sexiness is in general. Oh, right. Listen to the audiobook. Very nice work. Very nice. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I won't get into all of that. But yeah, I'm very pleased with the audiobook as a whole. All right. You can tip me. Yes, you can tip me. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. How much moral obligation would you say we who can hear the wind whistling through the tombstones of Western civilization owe, if any, to those who refuse to listen to the warnings versus preparing ourselves, and those who listen for the preparation of what comes next? Yeah, so you have to earn your way into indifference, in my opinion, right? And this is not some big moral thing. This is just what works for me, and maybe it'll work for you as well. So let's say that the shite hits the fan relatively quickly. Let's say there's issues in the supply chain. Let's say whatever, right? There's shortages and so on, right? And let's say that you have prepared, right? You have laid out food. You have whatever you needed to do. So you really, 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 I think, now, let me not talk about you because I'm saying this is about me. So what I've really wanted to do, and what I have done, is I've talked to people I care about and said, you know, I can't guarantee when, but it seems inevitable that winter is coming and you should probably, I mean, really strongly suggest that you lay in some security, some plan, some contingency, right? And I will repeat that and repeat that and repeat that. Now, most of the people I know are very much down with all of that and have made their plans and their preparations and so on, right? Good. The people who don't listen, I was saying this to a couple the other day. You know, freedom for other people is freedom for you. People are perfectly free not to listen to me. Obviously, you can leave anytime you want in the course of this conversation. People are perfectly free to not listen to me, not listen to you. And if people don't listen to your needs, right? Like if you're saying to someone you should prepare for something that could potentially be negative, and if they scorn you or ignore you or laugh at you or call you crazy or whatever, right? It's okay, well, they're not responding to your needs. They're ignoring and mocking and scorning your needs. Okay. Treat people the best you can when you first meet them. After that, treat them as they treat you. So the wonderful thing, the liberating thing about people who scorn and mock you for your rational warnings is that because they are indifferent to and scornful to your needs, you are perfectly free to be scornful and indifferent to their needs if, say, they're hungry or whatever, right? So it's the grasshopper and the ant, right? The ant who's working hard all summer to store up food for the winter says to the grasshopper, hey, man, you got to store up some food for the winter or whatever, right? And the grasshopper laughs and mocks and makes fun of the ant. Okay, well, then the ant is perfectly free to not support the grasshopper when winter comes. So you got to earn your way to indifference, I think. At least that's what's worked for me. And so, yeah, I have a lot of care and sympathy for the world. I want everyone to be happy and rational and virtuous and have all kinds of love and children and joy. And I expressed that for the 17 years I've been running this conversation. And having put my time in to help prepare people for what mathematically is kind of inevitable, if they haven't listened to me, if they've scorned me, mocked me, attacked me, insulted me, slandered me, whatever, right? Okay, well, I'm now free. I'm just free as a bird, baby. I am freedom. Nothing is better than the freedom, right? Yeah, I'm at great liberty. They They are free to ignore me, and now I am free to ignore them. Because I will not be a slave to other people's lack of listening. I will not be a slave to other people's lack of heeding. I will not sacrifice my interest to save those who have attacked me. Of course not. Thanks, but I got a family of my own, friends and community, so no. There's great freedom. So I would say, yeah, work to warn people and tell them to prepare for, you know, potential issues and so on. And if they listen, great. If they don't listen, you're perfectly free to not save them. So, all right. Stefan, thank you for your wisdom. I've been listening to you for a good few years now. 3 kids. I never wallop them, but I can't control my drinking. I know what to do, but don't know how to do it. Now, I don't know, obviously. You might want to check for physical addictions and get yourself checked out by a doctor, of course, right? But my guess would be that there's some trauma deep down that you're self-medicating. If you discover and uncover and deal with that trauma, your desire to drink will probably vanish, and you won't even remember why you had such a compulsion to do that. The modern woman paradoxically spends the most amount of time in front of the mirror and the least amount of time reflecting on themselves. That's a foolish thing. It's a foolish thing to focus on looks, because looks are going to fade. The value my mother brought was apparently just sex and then not being around because her personality was so odious. Well, you understand those two things are related, right? So what I'm saying is, the more sexualized the presentation, the more odious the personality, right? I mean, if you look at the people who are the most hypersexualized in terms of, like, I don't know, the Kardashians and Jennifer, is it Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez or whatever, people who hypersexualize, they just have these terrible relationships, just crash through people over and over and over again, right? So the more sexualized the presentation, the more volatile and disastrous the relationship is going to be. So, all right. I once dated a girl who did beauty pageants. She has pictures of her, just herself, in her apartment. Almost thought that was odd. Yeah, well. Would love to do a call-in show with you, Steph, to explore this further. I would be very happy to do a call-in shoe with you as well. And I'm going to, sorry to be rude to everyone, but it's been a while since I've done this, and I would like to, of course, have a bit more of a private conversation just for the supporters. So I'm going to flip this over to supporters for the last 25 minutes or so. And I'm going to do that, of course. If you want to rejoin, just go to freedomain.locals.com and you can sign up for free, all caps UPB 2022, and you can get a month free to get the book and History of Philosopher series and a bunch of podcasts and call-in shows that were a bit spicy for the mainstream, or way too spicy for the mainstream. So I'm going to flip this over to supporters only. Join me back again if you can. And thanks, of course, to everyone who's supporting the show to allow me to continue to do this. So flip over and here we go. Can someone be good and then become bad? Or has that person always been bad? Or is everyone pretty much a mix? Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can be good and then become bad. I mean, children are born with the potential to be good and often scarred into being bad. And of course, somebody can have a momentum of virtue from a youth that is troubled if they have sort of on the right path, but if they allow their undercurrents and undertow to take them down, often through addiction, then they definitely become bad. I know you have done the podcast Fall of Rome before. I'm glad you are no longer doing politics. I'm curious about the idea of the meek shall inherit the earth. Do you have a perspective about that means, particularly with the current global landscape? Yeah, the meek shall inherit the earth. We get a free society when parents stop waging war against their own children. So yeah, the meek, the kind, the gentle, with regards to their own children, that is the only possible future that we can have. So yes, the meek shall inherit the earth is a presage of peaceful parenting. All right. But I don't think I have any deep trauma that makes me drink. How do I find that out without making one up? Well, don't make one up. Obviously, you've got to be an empiricist. And we can talk about this more. But of course, the other thing too is you could be embedded in a social situation or a social circle that encourages your drinking. It's very hard to maintain any addiction without enablers and supporters and co-addicts in your environment. All right. Steph, any tips for dealing with early toddlerhood and the terrible twos? My son just turned 2 last week and has been a high-needs baby since he was born. Recently, he's begun having temper tantrums if he doesn't get his way, i.e. eating ice cream for every meal. I've tried bargaining and reasoning, but he's still a little too young to grasp the concepts. We are practicing peaceful parenthood. Any tips would be great. Well, okay, first of all, you don't give him ice cream for every meal, in my opinion, right? I mean, there's some people who say like this is an unparenting thing. It's like, oh, if your kid wants chocolate for every meal, give them chocolate for every meal, and they'll soon get sick of chocolate and so on. But, you know, I guess my concern is that, you know, health issues would be fairly significant, and fat cells gained when you're young, well, fat cells only shrink. They never vanish unless you get them hoovered out in some function. So, so you don't give in. And this is the thing, right? If you say, well, first of all, you got to sympathize with the child. The child says, I want ice cream. You're like, so do I. So do I. Because what we do is we distance ourselves from that and say, well, you can't have ice cream. Having ice cream, like, it's crazy to want ice cream. You shouldn't want ice cream. It's like, no, listen, don't you like ice cream? Whatever food it is that your kid likes. We all have a weakness for particular kinds of foods. And, you know, if I could live on carrot cake and caramel topping for the rest of my life, I'd be pretty sorely tempted to. But so, you know, when I was younger and my daughter and I were shopping in the grocery store or something, and, you know, they have all these evil psycho electric Kool-Aid covered colored candy right at the exit aisle to make sure that the meltdowns occur right by the cashier. And my daughter would be like, I want the candy. I'm like, oh man, so do I. I said, you know, when I was your age, I had this fantasy that I would just grow up and I'd earn money and I would just spend all my money on candy and I would just eat candy all day. Like, I would love to eat candy all day. It's so good. It's so good. So I'm with you, man. I would love that candy too, right? Well, can we get some? Well, there are problems with candy, you know. It's bad for your teeth. It's bad for your health. You know, you can get a toothache. You can get fat. You can get diabetes. You can, you know, really, really bad things. You know, it's not poison exactly, but it's not far off from poison. Sugar is not food. Sugar is not food. So, and you want to diagram it. You never have the conflict in the moment. Always have the conflict ahead of time. Because what happens, you get into the cycle as a parent. Your kid has a temper tantrum. Maybe you grit your teeth. Maybe you make it through. Maybe you say no. Maybe you say yes. And then after that all cools down, you don't want to have any more conflict, so you don't talk about the issue. But what you have to do, in my opinion, is you talk to your kids when there isn't any candy around and say, okay, let's figure out candy, right? And like my daughter, when she was younger, would constantly get cell phone data and Wi-Fi and Ethernet confused, right? There's no reason why she would have to know these things until I finally just pulled out a piece of paper and said, okay, this is a cell tower. This is a router. This is a cable, you know, just because, you know, I'm a bit fussy that way. It was driving me a little bit nuts when she would, we'd be in the car and she'd say, I want Wi-Fi. It's like, well, we don't have Wi-Fi. It's in the car. So no, it wasn't that way, but you sit down and explain it. You know, here's what happens when sugar hits your body. Here's why we are programmed by our bodies to want brightly colored sweet things, because especially if you're Northern European or Northern Asian or whatever, right, you absolutely needed fruit to survive, and fruit is brightly colored and sweet. So the reason why we are drawn to brightly colored sweet things, and I say, you know, you look, and I would do this with my daughter. I say, okay, what kind of fruit is this imitating? Oh, that's a lemon. Okay, what kind of fruit is this imitating? Oh, that's an apple, and this one is an orange. And, you know, get them to understand how they're being programmed by the candy providers to want the stuff, and empathize with the fact that it's super good tasting. I don't eat much. I don't eat a huge amount of sweets anymore, and I haven't for many, many years, but I did. I picked up, it was like one of those mini Snickers. It was floating around for some Halloween-y thing or whatever, right? I picked up that mini Snickers, and I popped it open, and I put it in my mouth and chewed. It was just like, oh, my God. Oh, I'm getting watery. My mouth is watering. Just, oh, it's so good. Oh, my God. It's so good. And, you know, Snickers is one of the things that I have kind of a weakness for. I used to enjoy the Nestle Crunch or whatever. I could never get that stuff out of my teeth. Peanut brittle, same. Macintosh toffee, same. But yeah, I was just like, man, that is like, it's so good. So empathize with your kid. Yeah, I would love to have ice cream for every meal. And if the kid understands that you're not saying no because you're mean, you're not saying no because you don't care, you're not saying no because you don't understand, you're saying no, you know, however. You know, and so you can have a conversation like this. So I remember saying to my daughter, I said, look, if I borrow a toy from you and I give it back to you broken, how are you going to feel? Mad. Why? You should take better care of my toy. You know, and you can do this at two. I promise you. Take your time. Break it down. You can do this with a two-year-old. So if I borrow a toy and I give it back to you broken, like let's say, oh, I just need to look something up on your tablet, and then I drop it and I hand you back the tablet. It's got a cracked screen. You know, or I borrow your xylophone and I bring it back and it's broken, or I, you know, whatever, right? It's mad. You got to take care of things, right? Okay, well, I'm borrowing you from the future. Like, you're going to be an adult, and it's my responsibility to make sure you get to be an adult strong and healthy. You understand that, right? Like, I mean, if you had a pet, you have a hamster, you have a dog, you can't let that hamster or dog, like, you can't not feed them or only feed them candy, because the hamster or the dog or the cat will get sick and die, right? You can't give dogs chocolates, bad for them, right? So you're like something I'm borrowing from the future. And I have to, in a sense, give you to the future happy. I don't want you, like, let's say that I let you have all the candy in the world and you get sick and you get fat. Okay, well, fat people, just look around. We go to the mall, you can look around. How many old people do you see who are really fat? Not many. You see these, you know, guys who are 98 dancing, they're always, you know, skinny as rails, right? Do you see, like, show me an old fat person. I'm happy, like, maybe I've missed something out here. Show me an old fat person, right? And they can't, right? So it's like, I want you to live a long, happy life. And I want you to be, you know, if you want to date or marry, I want you to be attractive. And I've got to deliver you healthy. I can make a choice about that. And I would love to eat ice cream all the time. Oh, it's so good. Especially, you know, those waffle cones. So good, right? But we have to say no to ourselves from time to time. Sometimes a lot. We have to say no. And of course, you have to model it yourself. Don't indulge in things yourself, right? So, you know, I mean, I've obviously said to my daughter a number of times, oh, I don't want to go exercise, but I'm going to go exercise. Would you like to come and chat? Make it better or whatever, right? So I have to show her, you know, there have been times, it's not often, but rarely or occasionally, I'm like, oh, I really don't want to do a show. And then when I start doing the show, it's fine, right? But I have to show her that I'm doing things. You know, I don't want to do my taxes. But, you know, you do these things. So model it and all that. So, all right, let's see here. All right. I drink alone a lot of the time. My wife tries to stop me. I think it might be genetic. Is that possible? I don't know. I don't know much about the genetics of alcoholism, but the question is, what's your mind? What's your state of mind when you're not drinking alone? Do you enjoy your own company? Do you feel relaxed in your own skin? Do you enjoy the process of your own thoughts? You know, if you can't enjoy the process of your own thoughts and you can't stand being alone in a dark room without a tablet or a phone, you're going to have some issues in your life. You have to enjoy your own company, because then the people you're with are a choice, not a desperation. Hi, Steph. How do you settle down as a man when you're given so many options? There's a lot of female employees where I work, and I often hear through word of mouth about some of them wanting to date me. Well, you settle down when you can't do better. Right? I mean, I hope that you're listening to this show live. Thank you again so much, wonderful supporters and listeners. I hope that you're listening to the show live. In fact, I know that you are, because you can't do anything better with your time. I agree, trust me. But you can't do anything better with your time. So there's no upgrade from this show for you, otherwise you'd be doing that other thing. And when you meet that woman where you're like, okay, this, like, I can't do better than this, then you settle down. All right. Wow, Steph, you really went all out with your daughter. I'd love to eat carbs and sugar, but I'd also like to keep my feet. You don't want to end up Aretha Franklin style, right? No, Aretha Franklin, well, she was kind of obese, but no, Ella Fitzgerald, didn't she end up in a wheelchair? She lost her legs or something, right? Cadbury Flake was my kryptonite. Oh, man, that stuff is good. Because, of course, it was the kind of thing you could pretend to smoke like a cigar as well. So, although I've always hated cigars. All right. Like the one or two that I've tried in my entire life. All right. Thank you, Steph. You're truly amazing. I appreciate that. You guys, you bring out the best in me. Like my family. You're my internet family. Thank you. That's very kind. All right. I'll just wait for another question or two to pop in here. And we shall go over here. Yeah, the COVID virus. I mean, I remember a guy sent me a book and really insisted that I read it about there being no such thing as a virus. I did not find it compelling. It was a lot of correlation without causation and no particular scientific arguments from the ground up. So there is definitely that. It's not something I subscribe to. Again, I'm open to any arguments from anyone, anywhere, at any time, but I have not found that to be compelling as yet. There just doesn't seem to be enough information. Kamala, the Ugandan giant, pro wrestler from Detroit, ended up losing his legs and in a wheelchair. Very sad. Oh, from obesity, yeah. You're right. There is nothing better than being here with you when you were on the long-deserved vacation. I sorely miss you. Do you think polygamy works? I do not think polygamy works. But yeah, but you need monogamy in order for a solid pair bonding with regards to raising the children, but you also need it because if you have polygamy, then you will end up with a relatively small number of high status males getting most of the women, and then you end up with a truly unstable group and gathering of young men who don't have any access to reproduction, and then they can't be tamed by society. So in a sort of positive way. So did you see the under oath testimony of Jay Smile speaking about how the vaccine was never tested against stopping transmission before the vaccine was released? Yeah, I saw it. The thing that always troubled me about all of that was, if it reduces symptoms, then aren't people walking around transmitting without even knowing that they're ill, or not really thinking maybe it's just a mild headache or whatever it is, or a mild cold? So, yeah, suppression of symptoms. Symptoms are one thing that happens, so you stay home, right? I mean, if you're really sick, you stay home. Suppressing symptoms has people walking around and still spreading it. So it does seem to be, I think, kind of worse in a way, but. Yeah, I mean, and this was all known, right? This is all, I was talking about this 2 years ago, that of course they didn't test for transmission, right? Apologies if you covered it recently, but what did you think of the recent Dharma series on Netflix? I don't know why people are obsessed with horrific serial killers, and the recent series felt like a glorification. It was bad taste, in my opinion, very hard to watch. There's stuff I can say about it, there's stuff that I choose not to say about it. The victims, with the exception of the Laotian boy, were fatherless. And I thought that was very interesting. With the exception of the Laotian boy, the victims were fatherless. There is, of course, also the drive to make the victims as pure and perfect as humanly possible to increase the pathos of their demise. And so, you know, there's this thing that happens in art these days. People can't just be honest in their art. They can't just explore the human condition. They can't explore their own thoughts and feelings. Everything has to go through this incredibly boring, politically correct filter. You know, like you can't just say, well, I'm going to have this character from this group or this race or this whatever, right? You just can't have this character and explore the genuine experience of that character. And it, you can't interview people and get the actual facts. It's always got to be, well, how does this portrayal affect equity and inclusion, and so you can't just have an honest conversation about anything in the art world anymore, because you know there are always the hair trigger groups and blowback and criticism and boycotts and blah 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 blah, and art has become kind of dull and boring as a whole. But yeah, I mean, the victims were all fatherless, and the most involved father was Jeffrey Dahmer's father. It wasn't particularly positive towards a father's, but yeah, it's a pretty tragic series. Now, why are people so obsessed with this? Well, because we're always obsessed with predators. I mean, we spent most of our evolution as prey in many ways, right? So of course we're obsessed with predators. That makes sense. And it's funny too, you know, how there's this general criticism of police, particularly in America these days. And of course, there's a lot of the defund the police stuff, and you know, it's pretty hard to miss the fact that the lack of police presence is continually decried in this area. I mean, there's this awful story where I'm sure you know this, right? But there was this 14-year-old, I think he was the Laotian boy, this 14-year-old boy was trapped and drugged in Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, managed to escape out onto the road, staggering. I think he'd had his head drilled at this point or whatever, but he had long hair and so on, and there was this, the black woman who plays the neighbor, oh, what an incredible actress, man. She was just fierce and just a brilliant, brilliant portrayal of a very sort of passionate woman. Again, no father, of course. And she and the other women, again, I think they were mostly black women, in the apartment building, were trying to protect this boy, and the cops came by, and Jeffrey Dahmer came by. So I was like, oh, he's my boyfriend. He's 18. He's just drunk and all that. And the cops helped the boy back into Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment, where Jeffrey Dahmer ended up killing the boy. And it's just appalling. Just an appalling, awful, awful story, as you can imagine. So, yeah, I mean, so then it's like, okay, well, the problem is the absence of the police. Oh, wait, no, the problem is the presence of police. And it's like, yeah, there's a lot of conversations to be have about that kind of stuff. So, bum, 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 bum. Lauren Southern did an interview with Adam Lane Smith. He talks about how male and female depression are different. Female depression is a lack of social acceptance and love. Male depression stems from a feeling of a lack of control in their life. Do you agree? I'm not really doing interviews anymore. And so I think male depression, a feeling of lack of control in their life. I think depression generally comes from exploitation. So why are women depressed these days? Because they're being exploited for sex. And they're exploiting themselves in pursuit of male attention by offering up sex. So I think the depression for women comes from being exploited. How are men being exploited? Well, being exploited is tax livestock to pay for a variety of social programs that disproportionately benefit everything and everyone other than men, right? So, yeah, women are being exploited through sexuality. Men are being exploited through taxation. So I think that exploitation is probably the thing that we have the most in common as a whole. And of course, as I said earlier, if you want to teach people to hate others, then get them to exploit them first. The reason why women are kind of hostile towards men is because women, through the mechanism of the state, are somewhat exploiting male taxes and so on. So, all right. Do you have any particularly fond memories of an educational field trip with Isabella? Oh, yeah. I used to love the Science Center at Young and Eglinton when I was a kid, and we went there a bunch of times, which was just a blast. Or serial killers are into Satanism. Most were connected to the CIA. I don't know about, I mean, of course he was into Satanism, and there was a 9-year period where Jeffrey Dahmer didn't kill anyone, so he had the capacity to not kill. And I think part of it was just slipping down that tumbleweed, right? Just slipping down. And of course the amount of red flags and warnings and problems and issues and so on that were there, and the amount of just missed opportunities to intervene. It's just appalling. But again, he's such an unusual character, right? It's not like there's many serial-killing gay cannibals living next door, so it's really tough. Have you heard about the anti-oil protesters who threw soup over the Van Gogh, as a woman told me once, sunflowers painting? Yeah, just awful. Just awful. Well, of course, they superglued themselves to the wall, and they threw paint on Van Gogh, his painting, and of course super glue is made from oil, and beans, wasn't it, beans that they threw? So yeah, the beans are grown using machinery that use oil, and the metal and the everything uses oil. So yeah, it's just pretty, but they just, environmentalism is the urge to just destroy that which is beautiful and comfortable, because I mean it's just, you know, this watermelon, right? Green on the outside, red on the inside, because they never talk about eliminating the national debt and so on, right? They don't. And they never say, well, people shouldn't get divorced because that means you need two houses where you only needed one before, and that's really bad for the environment. So it's not really about the environment, right? If you really cared about the environment, the first thing you would target is fiat currency. Fiat currency, borrowing and debt and all of that, it stimulates massive consumption in the here and now, right? Oh, massive overconsumption. All borrowing is about consuming now and paying later. So fiat currency would be the first thing you would target. National debts is the first thing that you would target. And divorce, you would target. You'd work to keep the nuclear family together, and you'd have a cryptocurrency or something that is limited to run the economy. And you'd make sure that there would be no such thing as the national debt and unfunded liabilities and all that. But of course, they never care about any of that, because it's a lot more fun, I guess, to throw beans at at a picture. So, all right. Don't you have to hate and resent someone first in order to exploit them? No. The exploitation is called virtue, or they owe you, or whatever it is, right? It's payback, right? Men have exploited women forever, so it's fine if women get male taxation, and right? So you have to have someone feel like a victim, and then they feel like they're exploiting back. Yeah, maybe you sort of, I hear what you're saying about the hatred, but you trick them or you hide the exploitation from them. I mean, if you ask most women, where do most of your benefits come from, they wouldn't say male taxation, male labor. So you kind of fog and fool them into exploiting others, and then there's an unconscious mechanism that occurs, which then has them end up resenting those who they are exploiting, right? What do you think is the state of the economy? How bad do you think it will get? Thefuture.com. Sorry, no, not thefuture.com. Freedomain.locals.com. Read the future or listen to the future. So, all right. We are down to the last minute. Should it be explained oil paintings use vegetable oils, not petroleum products? Boy, it's a funny thing, eh, when you think of just how everyone got off animal oils, went on to vegetable oils, and obesity exploded, right? Well, of course, I mean, Americans are eating 500 to 600 calories more a day and mostly in snacks, and it's mostly crap. But yeah, it's funny how they said, well, stop using animal products and stop using meat and butter and eggs and bacon. And then everybody just got fat and life expectancy kind of went down. So, all right. Well, thanks, everyone. What a lovely, lovely evening with y'all folks of cattle prodding my eloquence. Thank you so much for dropping by tonight. If you're listening to this later, oh, hit me with a Y if you don't mind me publishing the private or subscriber only part out there, or rather hit me with an N if you don't want me to. I'd appreciate that. And yeah, it seems everyone's okay with it. Yeah, it was nothing too spicy, right? Have yourselves a wonderful evening, everybody. Lots of love. I did get your tip. Thank you so much, freedomain.locals.com, to help out the show there. you can also just go to freedomain.com/donate and check it out there as well. Lots of love. Take care, everyone.